Late in July, I learned that the President of the United States would welcome a meeting with me in order to survey the entire world position in relation to the several and common interests of our respective countries. As I was sure that Parliament would approve, I obtained His Majesty's permission to leave the country. I crossed the Atlantic Ocean in one of our latest battleships to meet the President at a convenient place. I was, as the House knows, accompanied by the First Sea Lord, the Chief of the Imperial General Staff, and the Vice Chief of the Air Staff, together with the Permanent Secretary to the Foreign Office and others. We were therefore in a position to discuss with the President and with his technical advisers every question relating to the war and to the state of affairs after the war. Important conclusions were reached on four main topics. First of all, on the eight-point declaration of the broad principles and aims which guide and govern the actions of the British and United States governments and peoples amid the many dangers by which they are beset in these times. And secondly, on measures to be taken to help Russia to resist the hideous onslaught which Hitler has made upon her. Thirdly, the policy to be pursued towards Japan in order, if possible, to put a stop to further encroachments in the Far East, likely to endanger the safety or interests of Great Britain or the United States, and thus by timely action prevent the spreading of the war to the Pacific Ocean. Fourthly, there was a large number of purely technical matters which were dealt with, and close personal relations were established between high naval, military, and air authorities of both countries. I have, as the House knows, hitherto consistently deprecated the formulation of peace aims or war aims, however you put it, by His Majesty's government at this stage. I deprecate it at this time when the end of the war is not in sight, when the conflict sways to and fro with alternating fortunes, and when conditions and associations at the end of the war are unforeseeable. But a joint declaration by Great Britain and the United States is a process of a totally different nature. Although the principles in the declaration and much of the language have long been familiar to the British and American democracies, the fact that it is a united declaration sets up a milestone or monument which needs only the stroke of victory to become a permanent part of the history of human progress. The purpose of the joint declaration signed by President Roosevelt and myself on August the 12th is stated in the preamble to be to make known certain common principles in the national policies of our respective countries on which they base their hopes for a better future for the world. No words are needed to emphasize the future promise held out to the world by such a joint declaration by the United States and Great Britain. I need only draw attention, for instance, to the phrase, after the final destruction of the Nazi tyranny, to show the profound and vital character of the solemn agreement into which we have jointly entered. Questions have been asked, and will no doubt be asked, as to what is implied exactly by this or that point, and explanations have been invited. It is a wise rule that when two parties have agreed a statement, one of them shall not thereafter, without consultation with the other, seek to put special or strained interpretations upon this or that passage. I propose, therefore, to speak today only in an exclusive sense. First, the joint declaration does not try to explain how the broad principles proclaimed by it are to be applied to each and every case, which will have to be dealt with when the war comes to an end. It would not be wise for us at this moment be drawn into laborious discussions on how it is to fit all the manifold problems with which we shall be faced after the war. Secondly, the joint declaration does not qualify in any way the various statements of policy which have been made from time to time about the development of constitutional government in India, Burma, or other parts of the British Empire. We are pledged by the declaration of August 1940 to help India obtain free and equal partnership in the British Commonwealth with ourselves, subject, of course, to the fulfillment of obligations arising from our long connection with India and our responsibilities to its many creeds, races, and interests. Burma is also covered by our considered policy of establishing Burmese self-government and by the measures already in progress. At the Atlantic meeting, we had in mind primarily the restoration of the sovereignty, self-government, and national life of the states and nations of Europe now under the Nazi yoke, and the principles governing any alterations in their territorial boundaries which may have to be made. So that is quite a separate problem from the progressive evolution of self-governing institutions in the regions and peoples which owe allegiance to the British Crown. We have made declarations on these matters which are complete in themselves, free from ambiguity, and related to the conditions and circumstances of the territories and peoples affected. They will be found to be entirely in harmony with the high conception of freedom and justice which inspired the joint declaration. Since we last met, the Battle of the Atlantic has been going on unceasingly. In its attempt to blockade and starve out this island by U-boat and air attack, and the very formidable combination of U-boat and air attacks, the enemy continually changes his tactics. Driven from one beat, he goes to another. Chased from home waters, driven from the approaches to this island, he proceeds to the other side of the Atlantic. Increasingly hampered by United States patrols in the North Atlantic, he develops his malice in the South. We follow hard upon his track, and sometimes we anticipate his tactics. But it is not desirable to give him too precise, or above all, too early information of the success or failure of each of his various maneuvers. And it was therefore decided that the publication of our shipping losses at regular monthly intervals should cease. Accordingly, no statement of losses has been published for July and August, and I do not think the time has come to give the actual figures yet. The public, and indeed the whole world, have, however, derived the impression that things have gone much better in those 2 months. I cannot deny that that is so. The improvement in the sea war manifests itself in 2 directions. In the first place, there is a very great falling off in the sinkings of British and Allied ships, with a corresponding increase in the tonnage of invaluable cargoes safely landed on our shores. The estimates which I made at the beginning of the year of the volume of our importations for 1941, and which I mentioned to the House on another occasion, to which it would be improper to refer, the secret session, looked to me as if they would not only be made good, but exceeded. The second improvement is the extraordinary rise during the last 3 months in the destruction of German and Italian shipping. This has been achieved very largely by the development of new and brilliant tactics by the Coastal Command and by the Royal Air Force bombing squadrons acting with the Coastal Command. To the exploits of the Air Force must be added those of our submarines. I have for some time looked for an opportunity of paying a tribute to our submarines. There is no branch of His Majesty's forces which in this war suffered the same proportion of fatal loss as our submarine service. It is the most dangerous of all the services. That is perhaps the reason why the First Lord tells me that entry into it is keenly sought by officers and men. I feel the House would wish to testify its gratitude and admiration for our submarine crews, for their skill and devotion, which have proved of inestimable value to the life of our country. There are other perils which have been overcome, and other labors of splendid quality, which have been performed unknown, or almost unknown, to the public. I mentioned some of these to the House upon a private occasion, and it has been suggested to me that this particular reference should also obtain publicity. The first deals with the anti-mining service. We do not hear much about the mine menace now, yet almost every night, 30 or 40 enemy aeroplanes are casting these destructive engines with all their ingenious variations at the most likely spots to catch our shipping. The attack which began in November 1939, which began indeed when the war opened, with the ordinary moored mine laid by night in the approaches to our harbours, was succeeded before the end of 1939 by the magnetic mine, with all its mysterious terrors. and is now waged continually by the acoustic mind as well as by the magnetic in many dangerous combinations. We do not hear much about all this now, because by the resources of British science and British organization, it has been largely mastered. We do not hear much about it because 20,000 men and 1,000 ships toil ceaselessly with many strange varieties of apparatus to clear the ports and channels every morning of the deadly deposits of the night. You will remember the lines of Kipling. Mines reported in the fairway, warn all traffic and detain. Sent up Unity, Tarabel, Assyrian, Stormcock, and Golden Gate. This is going on night after night, day after day, and it may well be imagined, as the work has to be performed in all weathers and constantly under the attack of the enemy, how excellent is the service rendered by the brave and faithful men engaged in it. We do not hear much about them, because this work is done in secret and in silence, and we live on. We take it as a matter of course, like the feats of the salvage service, to which I must also refer. The salvage service has recovered since the beginning of the war, in every circumstance of storm and difficulty, upwards of 1,000,000 tons of shipping, which would otherwise have been cast away. These marvelous services of seamanship and devotion, and the organization behind them, prove at every stage and step the soundness of our national life, and the remarkable adaptiveness of the British mind and the tenacity of the British character, by which we shall certainly be saved and save others. Although, as I have admitted, there has been a very great improvement in our losses at sea in July and August, it would be a very foolish mistake to assume that the grave dangers which threaten us are at an end. The enemy has been employing a greater number of U-boats and also of long-range aircraft than ever before, and we must expect further increases. We have made prodigious exertions, and our resources are growing continually. The skill and science of the Admiralty staff and their commanders, working in perfect harmony with the Royal Air Force, have gained these successes. But the Admiralty would be the last to guarantee their continuance as a matter of course. And certainly the slightest relaxation of vigilance, of exertion, and of contrivance would be followed by a very serious relapse. It must be remembered also that the Germans are much hampered in the American parts of the Atlantic, which are very extensive, by the fear of trouble with the powerful American naval forces, which ceaselessly patrol the approaches to the Western Hemisphere. This has been a great help to us. I wish it might be a greater help. But here again, the enemy's tactics may change. No doubt Hitler would rather finish off Russia and then Britain before coming to close quarters with the United States. That would be in accordance with his habitual technique of one by one. Hitler has, however, also the greatest possible need to prevent the precious munition supplies now streaming across the Atlantic in pursuance of the policy of the United States government from reaching our shores. Should he do so, the area of the danger zones would again become ocean-wide. In the meanwhile, let us hear no vain talk about the Battle of the Atlantic having been won. We may be content with the successes which have rewarded patience and exertion. But war is inexhaustible in its surprises, and very few of those surprises are of an agreeable character. Now I turn to a far wider field. The magnificent resistance of the Russian armies, and the skillful manner in which their vast front is being withdrawn in the teeth of Nazi invasion, make it certain that Hitler's hopes of a short war with Russia will be dispelled. Already in 3 months, he has lost more German blood than was shed in any single year of the last war. Already he faces the certainty of having to maintain his armies on the whole front from the Arctic to the Black Sea, at the end of long, inadequate, assailed, and precarious lines of communication through all the severity of a Russian winter, with the vigorous counterstrokes which may be expected from the Russian armies. From the moment now nearly 80 days ago when Russia was attacked, we have cast about for every means of giving the most speedy and effective help to our new ally. I am not prepared to discuss the military projects which have been examined. Such a discussion would be harmful to our interests. both by what was said and by what was not said. Nor will it be possible for anyone representing the government to enter upon any argument on such questions. In the field of supply, more can be said. I agreed with President Roosevelt upon the message which was sent to Premier Stalin, the terms of which have already been made public. The need is urgent and the scale heavy. A considerable part of the munition industry and the iron and steel production of Russia had fallen into the hands of the enemy. On the other hand, the Soviet Union disposing of anything from 10 to 15 million soldiers, for nearly all of whom they have equipment and arms, to aid in the supply of these masses, to enable them to realize their long-continuing force, and to organize the operation of their supply, will be the task of the Anglo-American-Russian conference. We must be prepared for serious sacrifices in the munitions field in order to meet the needs of Russia. The utmost exertion and energy will therefore be required from all concerned in production in order not only to help Russia, but to fill the gaps which must now be opened in our longed-for and at last arriving supply. It must be remembered that everything that is given to Russia is subtracted from what we are making for ourselves, and in part at least from what would have been sent us by the United States. In terms of finished munitions, the flow of our own production in this country and the empire is still rising. It will reach full flood during this third year of our wartime munitions production. If the United States are to fulfill the task they have set themselves, very large new installations will have to be set up or converted, and there will have to be a further curtailment over there, as they fully recognize, of civilian consumption. We must ourselves expect a definite reduction in the military supplies from America, on which we have counted. But within certain limits, we are prepared to accept these facts and their consequences. If we now look back for a moment, we can measure the solid improvement in our position in the Middle East, or East, which has been achieved since the French suddenly fell out of the war, and the Italians made haste so eagerly to come in against us. At that date, all we had in those parts was from 80,000 to 100,000 men, starved of munitions and equipment, which had all been sent to the French front, always first to claim the best we had. We had lost our means of safe communication through the Mediterranean and almost all the main bases which we occupied. We were anxiously concerned for our defense of Nairobi, Khartoum, British Somaliland, and above all of the Nile Valley and Palestine, including the famous cities of Cairo and Jerusalem. None were safe, but nevertheless, after little more than a year, we have managed to gather very large and well-equipped armies, which already begin to approach 750,000 men, which possess and are being supplied with masses of equipment of all kinds. We have developed an air force almost as large as that we had in Great Britain when the war began, an air force which is rapidly expanding. We have conquered the whole of the Italian Empire in Abyssinia and Eritrea, and have killed or taken prisoner the Italian armies of over 400,000 men by which these regions were defended. We have defended the frontier of Egypt against German and Italian attack. We have consolidated our position in Palestine and Iraq. We have taken effective control of Syria and provided for the security of Cyprus. Finally, by the swift and vigorous campaign in Persia, which has taken place since the House last met, we have joined hands with our Russian allies and stand in the line to bar the further eastward progress of the enemy. I cannot help feeling that these are achievements which, whatever the future may contain, will earn the respect of history and deserve the approval of the House. Thus far, then, have we travelled along the terrible road we chose at the call of duty. The mood of Britain is wisely and rightly averse from every form of shallow or premature exaltation. This is no time for boasts or glowing prophesies. But there is this. A year ago, our position looked forlorn and well-nigh desperate to all eyes but our own. Today, we may say aloud before an awestruck world, we still are masters of our fate. We still are captains
of our souls.